Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
We're Building Bridges.
We're joined by Joe Burns, veteran union negotiator and director of collective bargaining for the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, author of Strike Back and Reviving the Strike and Beyond Liberalism. Let's talk about your most recent book, Class Struggle Unionism, other types of unionism after that. What is class struggle unionism?
For the first 100-some years of unionism in the United States, the main differences between the forms of unionism was between what we call bureaucratic business unionism and class struggle unionism. The difference stems from a pretty basic difference. How do you look at the employment transaction? Now, once you become of a certain age, a working class youth, you're required to go out and get a job, if not what for one employer, for another, and then work for the next 60-odd years or 50-odd years until you retire. And some people are even working during their retirement. But we rarely analyze that employment transaction. But it's a fundamental question for the labor movement and for the type of unionism that we choose. When you think of the bureaucratic business unions and you think of the American Federation under Samuel Gompers in the early 1900s, kind of continuing to a lot of the unions today, they see themselves as having a fairly limited role in society. Their slogan can be summed up by a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. They see themselves as basically, you know, bargaining with the individual employers. They may have to take them on and may even engage in strike activity against them. But ultimately, you know, their goal is to just get slightly better terms or better terms for the employment transaction, but don't really question the sort of fundamental makeup of society. In contrast to that, we have a long, rich history of a different type of unionism, class struggle unionism. So when you think of the industrial workers of the world in the early 1900s, who believe that labor creates all wealth and that we were in a fight with the owning class. When you think of the 1920s and the 1930s, the sort of communists and socialists who built the modern labor movement and then carried on to build a civil rights unionism in the South in the 40s and early 50s that was crushed by the Red Scare in many ways. More recently, you know, the sort of thousands of radicals who entered labor movement in the 70s, they had a very different view of society and the workplace transaction because their viewpoint was labor creates all wealth and that when workers go into work, what they share in common, all workers, is you can be a nurse or a barista or an auto worker, a factory worker, whatever you are. In the course of your shift, you take the inputs supposedly supplied by the employer and you transform them into something more valuable. You create value during your work shift. But the problem is, and the reason that we have this analysis of class struggle unionism, is that at the end of the work shift, you only keep a fraction of the value that you create. And the rest gets siphoned up by the employing class and to the billionaire class, or some people call them the capitalist class, in thousands and thousands and millions of transactions in the United States and around the world. And that's why and how we have billionaires in society. So out of the basic employment transaction. So class struggle unionism views it that labor creates all wealth. And from that very simple idea flows a very different, more radical, a lot more workplace-centered, a lot more democratic form of unionism than what we see from bureaucratic business unionism.
You also mentioned labor liberalism and progressive unionism. What are those?
I started doing labor work in the 1980s. You know, at the time, you know, we had a pretty vibrant sort of left wing of the labor movement. We were fighting against concessions, fighting against the AFL-CIO, or we called them the AFL-CIA's foreign policy, supporting dictatorships around the world. We had a pretty oppositional view towards a lot of the what we called the labor bureaucracy, the sort of stratum within labor who had different interests than the workers. That was a very vibrant part of the labor movement. But they're developed in the late 1980s and beyond the sort of third way in the labor movement, which I call labor liberalism. And these were a lot of, you know, maybe people who had been involved in the left movement in the 70s, but had kind of moved on to labor education or higher positions in the labor movement. They basically put out a third way that was basically adopt more progressive positions on social issues, we're going to fight smarter. We're not going to engage in the open-ended strikes. We're going to do one-day strikes, corporate campaigns. But at the center of it is going to be sort of the smart, educated staff people. We're going to have community ties. We're going to have a lot of items that business unionism doesn't have. But the problem with labor liberalism and the reason that it's failed for the last 30 years is they lack a lot of essential features of class struggle unionism. The idea of, like, class struggle unionism at its core values shop for struggle, values that, you know, sort of people who believe in, you know, class struggle believe that the workers must emancipate themselves. It's like a core tenet of, you know, going way back to, you know, Karl Marx and beyond, this idea that the workers need to lead their own struggles, yet labor liberals, you know, kind of believe that, you know, smart union staffers should be kind of running things. So those are fundamentally different points of view. You know, what I argue in my book is that, look, there were a lot of good things that came out of labor liberalism, like more progressive positions on immigration and social issues and so forth. And those are all sort of part of class struggle unionism. But it's time to move beyond it, and we need to return to sharper class-on-class struggle, which is at the core of class struggle unionism.
Well, Joe Burns, I want to know how, because there's a bureaucracy that's been created, and there's a hierarchy, of course, within that bureaucracy that is hardly what Ken and I used to get a real kick out of when we had some of the mine workers up here. Some of them had the old hats from years ago that said the shop stewards gun clubs. And these were guys with a real class consciousness, and they saw unions as a stepping stone to worker empowerment, to state empowerment of the working class. So how do you move from these stodgy, comfortable business unionism to break with that kind of liberalism and really have the workers assume control over the organizations that they built and really towards accomplishing state power? That's a heavy lift, but you actually tackle it. So give us some of those ideas.
Yeah, one of the things my friend Chris Townsend from the, you know, retired from the UE and the ATU, Transit Union, says is the left must lead the labor movement. So part of what we need to do in the labor movement is we need to rebuild a sort of vibrant class struggle trend that is very clear on what we need to do and what sort of labor movement we need. We need to start putting demands on the national unions. We need to form reform caucuses when necessary. Return to the sort of basic tenets of class struggle unionism for starting with those who are on more of the left of the trade union movement. I argue in my book that for the last couple of decades, we've been somewhat muddled and confused by this labor liberalism, and we haven't really operated according to our traditional principles. So I think class struggle unionism, you know, to revive it, it requires, you know, a number of things. One is we need to be clear ourselves as a trend within the labor movement. We need to organize around our principles. Then we also need to demand change within the labor movement, whether it's new leaders or sort of new programs that we have for the labor movement. It's a comprehensive program of what we need to do. And it may not be a short-term project. When you think of the fight for industrial unionism, a lot of people think that that came up just in the 1930s, but it was introduced at every AFL convention for the preceding 20 years. And both in and outside the AFL, there was a big fight about what sort of labor movement are we going to have. You know, I very much see that we need to kind of return to that sort of perspective and put ourselves on a little more sound footing.
And what about the rule of labor law? Is there over-dependence on that? Does it hobble us? What's your view of the labor law?
This is something I talk about in my first couple books at great length, Reviving the Strike and Strike Back. Over the decades, what employers have been able to do is transform labor law into the vehicle of their own choosing. When you look at the National Labor Relations Act or look at the various laws governing public employees, what you find is they offer very little in terms of protections for workers, but increasingly favor the repression against traditionally successful trade union activity. So when you look at the 1950s and 40s and earlier, the key tactics of the labor movement in the private sector were stopping production and tactics of solidarity. Those were considered, and I quote in my books, even traditional labor economists, like mainstream labor economists, viewed stopping production, like mass picketing and plant takeovers, as key elements for union strike activity. How could you win a strike if you couldn't stop production? Well, you fast forward, 50, 60 years, and employers are routinely going in even today and getting these really stringent injunctions against workers, against the mine workers and other striking workers, to limit it to a couple of workers on a picket line, and you stand there and watch the scabs go by. Part of reviving class struggle unionism is reviving class struggle tactics. Reviving class struggle tactics is going to require violating labor law. I tell people, what sort of labor movement would it take to be able to violate labor law? To be able on a widespread basis engage in that sort of activity. And the answer is, it looks a lot like what a class struggle labor movement would look like.
Can I just ask you how you might apply that, for example, to the railroad workers now? The railroad workers have yet to vote, although their union leadership seems to have acquiesced to the Biden administration compromise, which seems to leave in abeyance the major issue of their ghastly, dangerous health and safety, work conditions, etc. So while they do have a major rank and file that is still waiting to see the actual written contracts, we already have Nancy Pelosi, who's saying she wants more legislation, even though there is already existing law that can prevent the railroad workers, should they vote down the contract, should they decide to go out on strike. So how would you apply it in a situation which is so fraught with danger for the workers, has such a large area of the economy that would be affected? What would you say in that situation?
I think that's a very interesting question, because if you go back to the 1920s when the Railway Labor Act was passed, even the very stodgy and conservative rail unions back then, who were part of the Brotherhood, they called them back then, of representing the elite of the railroad industry, even they vigorously supported the right to strike and were opposed to any legislation that completely took away the right to strike. But we fast forward 100 years, I've seen a lot of commentary about the strike. I've seen a lot of what the unions are putting out. But very few are challenging the fundamental issue here, which is Congress should not have the ability to legislate an agreement and take away the right to strike for over 100,000 American workers. That's a violation of their fundamental right to strike. And yet you see very little sort of discussion of that key issue. Part of it is, sort of incorporation of the labor movement into the Democratic Party and the limitations on that. I think the railroad workers are going to have to speak themselves on, how do they view the, attendance policy changes versus, or the changes in the tentative agreement. I don't like to speculate on items folks are voting, because I think they need to decide for themselves, and I know they have an active reform movement. But that being said, I think it's a false choice that's being offered to the railroad workers, because in reality, it's not reject this agreement and strike. It's reject this agreement and have Congress ram it down your throat. And I think that's something that really should be fought against.
Joe, the employment process transactions are inherently exploitive. Now, we're talking about how to fight back, but should we also consider going beyond that conundrum to getting rid of capitalism? And what would that look like? It's a long question. I don't expect you to answer it, but just start us on that quest.
Oh, I want to be on that quest badly.
We are on the quest.
It is a quest.
So look, when I write the book Class Struggle Unionism, I view it as a pretty broad tent, right? So it's people who view the transaction as inherently exploitative. It leads to a form of unionism which values union democracy and fights for the entire working class, fights for the international working class, believes in sharp struggle and, sort of key components. But I think, and I touch on it in the book, but it's not like the central point, but I also talk a little bit about beyond trade unionism, because one of the things we need to understand, and I've been negotiating all I do for like the last 20, 30 years, is I'm at the bargaining table every week. We need to understand that even if you negotiate the best union contract in the world and you do a settlement, it's always somewhat bittersweet. Because at the end of the day, you're negotiating the terms of your exploitation. So you're negotiating terms where even if you win some good work rules and better pay and so forth, the value is still flowing upwards towards the billionaire. So even if the Amazon workers negotiated 10 bucks more an hour and got like better work rules, the end result of that would still be the money that they create and the value that they create flows up. And I think that's the problem the labor movement had in the 1950s. Because they negotiated some really good contracts for a section of the working class, not the entire working class, but for, you know, broad swatches of the working class. But at the same time, these billionaires and millionaires and billionaires were being created. And when you think about it, when they have that much money, like Jeff Bezos, you know, like, if you know, a billionaire has $10,000. If you had a billionaire, you could spend $1 billion. You could spend $10,000 a day for 274 years. It's like unimaginable wealth. And then you got someone with Bezos who has 150 times that. But what is wealth? What is capital? It's a social relationship. It's power. It's the ability to command, you know, resources in society. So what they do is they take that money and power, even if you have a strong labor movement, and they buy the politicians and the judges and they turn it against us. So I don't see in the long run how we can have a labor movement that doesn't believe that we need to fundamentally transform the economy and the system of exploitation and abolish it.
I think that's
to be continued. Now let's give Joe Burns the last word with this segment from his recent speech on class struggle unionism.
I think overall, the system's not working for us. Business unionism, by its nature, is very conservative. Folks like established procedures, the grievance procedure, arbitration, set negotiations, kind of a way of doing it, and they develop these bureaucracies to deal with it that way. But the problem is, as they say, capital is a relentless force. The society and the economy is constantly changing, and employers, as I've noted, use their influence to change the rules of the game over the decades. And the stable bargaining that might have existed 40, 50 years ago is gone. Now we have the added pressure of changes in the economy, the auto workers. There's an inevitable shift towards electric vehicles. The question of, are those going to be union or not? What sort of jobs are they going to have and so forth? So there's these big questions, and also, what is our role? Are we going to allow the corporations to set the policy on climate change, which affects working class communities overwhelmingly? When the water becomes scarce or resources, who's going to be in a better position to protect themselves? Obviously, the billionaires. So I think that class struggle unionism as an approach is really the only philosophy for the labor movement to be able to tackle these big issues, both because class struggle unionism by its nature is very broad-based, but I think also it provides both practical guidance and a set of ideas that can validate the tactics that we're going to need as a labor movement to take on capital, which is a whole discussion. I have a whole chapter discussing class struggle tactics and what would we need for a movement to be able to do the bold actions to violate labor law that we've seen glimpses of, right? We saw the Occupy movement, which even though it wasn't part of the labor movement, it was a working class movement against the 1%. We also seen that with the Wisconsin uprising. So where thousands of workers surrounded the state capitol in Wisconsin in about 2012. We can call it the Tale of Two Cities. The AFL-CIO met in Philadelphia, really dominated by the heads of the international unions. They had their convention, passed resolutions, and so forth. This they really, which they've done for decades, failed to take into account the fundamental crisis that we face. They came up with the great idea that they were going to organize 100,000 workers per year, which I think if you do the math and you look at the growth of the labor market, it would mean that the percent of workers we represent would actually go down because their bold, ambitious plans, which is in quotes, don't even match up with the growth of the labor movement, nor the loss of union jobs that you would have to just organize just to be on a treadmill and keep even. So I think that on the level of big strategy, we can't just plod along. And we need a set of ideas, I call it class struggle strategy, that takes on these bigger issues. If you look back 100 years ago or even less than that, a lot of the radicals and socialists in the labor movement, they didn't just plod along in their own little shop and try and be great organizers. They put demands on their national unions, and they had bold plans. Like at the AFL conventions up until the 1930s, they debated every year. The left of the labor movement would be demanding that they organize industrial workers. And it took them a couple decades of fighting within the labor movement, and folks formed unions outside of it and did everything they could to do that. But they had bold plans about how we can take on employers and the employer class. And we don't really see that much in the labor movement today. We see the business unionists having their heads down. And now that the Democrats are back in office, Biden is in office, I think a lot of them, the DC labor officials, are probably happy, right? They're getting invited to the White House and being on committees, and their sense of crisis, I'm sure, has gone way down. But even for the progressive trade unionists, I think we've been a little bit too much focused on, because the mainstream unions and the AFL-CIO, a lot of these business unionism suck so bad, a lot of folks have said, oh, we're just going to go do it ourselves, right? We're going to form worker centers. We're going to go out and become good organizers and have our little piece of the labor movement. That really can't work. We need the resources and the command of the entire labor movement, and that requires demanding that our unions and the labor movement in general take a more aggressive approach. Yeah, so I think there's a couple of pieces to this. One is on the job tactics. A lot of unions have really given up control of the shop floor, which was a key area of struggle. So back in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, a lot of workers, even in the business unionists, would control the output of their work and could put pressure on the employer on the shop floor. What happened is there was a deal with the devil. You take an industry like auto, where the UAW in the late 1970s went for these programs like Team Concept, which they partnered with the employer in the name of addressing competition. But what they did is they ended up just speeding up the work and giving up control over production standards and control of the workers. And they would go to these systems where they'd work in a team, and if anyone was slow, someone would stop the production, and then they'd go after the person who's dragging it down, which is really not dragging it down, just grabbing a breath. So I think fundamentally, how do we regain power on the shop floor takes a different form of unionism. But even beyond that, we're at 6% of the private sector, and yeah, we can organize Starbucks and Amazon, which are great, but the nut we really have to crack is, how do we regain bargaining power? How do we gain power to force employers to drastically improve the lives of workers? And to do that, we have to confront that there's a repressive set of labor laws which outlaw traditionally effective trade union activity. So one of the things that labor law does is it forces workers to bargain and strike at these even very narrow units. So they'll be striking or bargaining at one plant of a giant corporation. And that doesn't work, and it never did work. And it goes against traditional labor union theory, where even the business unionists 50, 100 years ago would say we need to strike the entire industry at once. So if you look at the strikes in the past, 1959, you got 500,000 steelworkers striking at once. Well, think of the power you have when you're able to shut down the national economy. Look at 1946, right after World War II. You got hundreds of thousands of workers in different industries, mine workers, railroad workers, the auto workers, everyone going out and strike at once. And it really flexed the muscle and the power of the working class. So regaining those tools of solidarity isn't going to be easy because Congress isn't going to amend the law. The courts aren't going to let us do it. We're going to have to do it the old fashioned way in all likelihood, which is violating law and defying injunctions. Workers finally have the ability to go out on strike. And the billionaire class and their representatives are changing monetary policy to try and drive us into a recession. But when you go beyond that and you start seeing workers operating as a class, which is what you get when you have strikes that are industry-wide or general strikes, that's really destabilizing to these folks who claim to support workers, because workers are acting as a class and really calling into question the entire system. The traditional labor union theory would see that the government's somewhat misguided, maybe they've been captured by conservative forces, but generally is or should be a protector of workers' rights. A lot of their policies are, let's get the government more involved in labor relations. Some of the folks are calling for mandatory arbitration of first contracts and these government sectoral bargaining and so forth. But us class struggle unionists are traditionally very skeptical of that, because we see that the role of the government and the courts, their primary role in society, is to facilitate this system of exploitation of workers. We have to have our own counter set of ideas. What do we believe in? The Occupy movement had that. Our streets. These are public squares. Those are transformative ideas that run counter to the set of ideas that are in place and drummed by the media and the courts and the politicians. The deeper problem is the Democratic Party is a party that's primarily funded by the billionaire class who have deep influence over the policies. So to the extent that the labor movement and the labor officials get so tied into that, it's really an entree into the labor movement from the ideas and the practices and the priorities of the billionaire class. And that's fundamentally corrosive. And I think we've seen it over time with the international politics to foreign policy, to this soft approach on the Democrats when they get in office and not holding their feet to the fire. So I think part of the class struggle approach is that we need to break from that abusive cycle. We need to build a militant labor movement that we can rest independent politics on, because the labor movement's so screwed up now it can't anchor a militant class struggle party, because we're not a militant labor movement.
And if you want to pick up on it, Class Struggle Unionism by Joe Burns, a negotiator par excellence, a great writer. Class Struggle Unionism, that's what we need. That's how we move forward. Do get a copy of that. And let's get the seat of production to meld with the community sector so that we can realize that wonderful reality that, well, state power, because workers do create all the wealth. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And this has been Building Bridges, and we've built bridges this evening with Joe Burns, author of Class Struggle Unionism. Thank you for listening. Thanks for writing the book, and thanks for the work you do, Joe.